welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It is now hour number two, and we're going to go straight through from hour two to hour three. Perhaps there might be a quick, sneaky WikiLeaks sneaked in there at some point, but it's going to go straight through rather than the thing, because my very special guest, Eric Rice, has to go home. All right? I don't have to say it twice. And we're talking about Drug Lord, the documentary. They've got a little thingy on Kickstarter there. And if you can't donate some money in order to finish this film, just...
It's not a donation. You're pre-ordering the DVD, the T-shirt. Have a look at the Kickstarter, and you'll see it's not just a gift. You're getting something for your cash.
All right. Well, in that case, go and purchase something for a product that is not yet made.
Well, no, the T-shirts, for those of you who are watching the podcast, which we may put online, this is the T-shirt, the official movie T-shirt I'm wearing right here, screen printed by a very good artist, Dallas, excellent screen printing on this T-shirt. It's a high quality.
I thought that was a TV show.
No, you're confusing that with some other kind of Dallas. No, the man's name is Dallas, and he's a screen printing artist. He's not a regular kind of screen printer. This man is sharp.
So he's not a ex-porno guy? He wasn't in Debbie Does Dallas?
No connection to that film.
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
I'm taking it in a terrible direction. And something that rhymes with direction. And when you talk about the movie... which is probably the whole purpose of it. Now, let's see if we can run through the film, chapter by chapter, verse by verse. You know, incidentally, we've got 120 minutes. We've got 120 minutes to cover a 100-minute film.
That's right, but we're going to cut that film down to 90 minutes, so that's why this 120-minute interview is going to rocket along at a huge pace, to give people a sense of the pace of the film when it's completed. It's a very dense film, but it's like a roller coaster ride, which you know you're feeling the complexities at every turn, because the story twists and turns at a rapid rate through the last 100 years of history, actually. Mm-hmm. Well, for example, the most recent turn was the full legalization of cannabis in Washington and Colorado, basically, this puts the United States in violation of UN treaties which it itself crafted and which the rest of the world has signed. So if the United States can violate these UN treaties, then other countries, including New Zealand, can also, because obviously these are not binding treaties. So that's a massive game changer, and the number of countries that recognize that and change their drug laws could have a domino effect, which means the entire prohibition, not of drugs generally, I don't believe, I'm not that hopeful, but of cannabis, could fall over within the next 10 years.
10 years, you say. And how many years have we got of prohibition so far, like 70?
Well, it depends if you take the starting point, 1906, which is when the first cannabis prohibitions were introduced, or 1937, when it was made federally illegal in the United States, or 1971, when Richard Nixon declared the modern drug war. So we're talking about just over 100 years, or the last 40 years, if you're just talking about the modern drug war era.
The modern drug war era, I think it should be pronounced more correctly.
Yeah, it was a gigantic era. One of the most costly blunders in terms of public policy that's ever been. Possibly the most costly public error.
Can we eliminate the need for mistakes and possible quaffling and whatnot? It was done deliberately by specific scumbags for a very, very evil agenda. And it's very, very obviously fits the definition of a conspiracy, doesn't it?
It was indeed a conspiracy. If you look at Richard Nixon's conspiracy, it involves appointing a conservative Republican governor, Raymond Schaefer, who actually refused to co-conspire with Nixon. and published a report saying that marijuana should be decriminalized. So Nixon binned the Schaefer Commission's report, had Schaefer discredited, using the power of the other people who were tied to the Oval Office and the newly created Drug Czar Office. They created a set of drug laws that were in direct contradiction to what the Schaefer Mission's findings, very conservative findings, stipulated. So Nixon definitely gerrymandered the laws. He took the laws into his own hands. In fact, more than taking the laws into his own hands, he created laws which were then in his hands from that time until his demise as president.
He's got the drug laws
in his hands. No, let's not sing. This is a family-friendly show. We don't want the dogs howling in the background. Nixon was a very evil character. And we shouldn't be following him blindly into the abyss, which is what we've been doing globally since the time he concocted the drug war fiasco.
Conveniently, he's dead, right?
It's convenient and inconvenient. I mean, if he was still alive, you know, we could hold him accountable.
We could do a documentary about him called An Inconvenient Douche.
Have you used that one before? It's fresh. That was fresh, listeners at home.
Yeah, they get worse. For my haters, yes, there is more to come.
Nixon, I don't know how familiar people are with Nixon, because he's been dead a long time. As you point out, he is dead. But Nixon had some great little personal stories involving Elvis Presley and the drug war, and conscripting Elvis Presley as a special agent of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics. The irony being that Elvis was himself an alcoholic and pharmaceutical drug addict, and died as a result of ingestion of those drugs. So that was one of his PR stunts to get other countries like New Zealand. This actually worked to get New Zealand on board with the drug war. So celebrities back then were doing what they're doing now in terms of serving the ruling agenda.
I heard that Elvis died for a couple of reasons, right? There's drug and everything. He wasn't a very healthy man, but allegedly
he was not healthy.
Allegedly he was whacked, all right? Because when he was recruited, he was like real anti-drug and stuff like that, and then he just wanted to kind of infiltrate and do his part for the country and that kind of thing, get into the drug scene because a whole bunch of people invited him because he's fucking Elvis, you know? And of course, if you're a massive big rock star, you get offered all the drugs and everything. So he offered himself to the US government, and they used him. The problem is he got so deep in that he started to realize that it was the US government dealing the drugs. And he was going to start talking about it, allegedly, and then he died, conveniently.
I've been to his home, and I've visited his final resting place. I've seen the bullet holes and the TV, and he was definitely exhibiting a lot of signs of deep alcohol dependence, you know, in terms of his violent and erratic behavior, you know, shooting off firearms and so forth. He was definitely acting as an agent of the government. I don't know if we can ever prove your contention that it was an assassination. But
it's not mine, Neil. It's a good Stu Webb. He's been a government whistleblower for like 15 years or something.
No. It's not beyond the realms of imagination. But the government, and specifically the CIA, were definitely in the drug trade at that time that Elvis was overdosing. In fact, you see at that time it was Air America, the heroin trafficking from Southeast Asia, that morphed into the Iran-Contra scandal. Once again, weapons and drugs involved in that, where where a democratically elected Central American government was overthrown by a coup funded by cocaine, and the arms were supplied and the drugs were trafficked by the CIA under the command of General Oliver North, who actually confessed to doing this and later on got a show on the Fox News Network. So that's how it rolls, man. Confess to major drug trafficking and arms trafficking and get a TV show as punishment.
You would have to deal with all of those television types, you know, sometimes.
That's true. That could be grueling.
They can be kind of, I guess the word really has to be scumbaggery just again, you know. There's just a general air of scumbaggery about mainstream media that I feel it's palpable, you know. It's like cockroaches crawling on your skin at night when you sleep.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I've been through the door and I've seen the other side, and I think they're just human beings at the end of the day who don't understand the bigger picture. I empathize with people in the marketing world as individuals, but and marketing and media, but in general, no. I think that these edifices are serving the purposes of a ruling cabal that does not have your spiritual and human needs at heart at all.
If anything, it's the direct opposite, isn't it? You know.
No, it is. It's a.
Well, people always argue, you know, they go like, "Oh, why would somebody be like so corrupt as to create an entire drug scheme that makes billions of dollars for private weapons contractors and creates an enormous black market by which the government can finance all its black secret ops?" I don't understand why somebody would do that. It just seems crazy. It's like, yeah. Well, that's because you're not a criminally negligent psychopath.
Yeah.
Okay, you know. If you were suddenly, I get it.
Yeah, well, the trust in government is astonishing, considering the fact that, like in the case of Oliver North, he confessed in front of a grand jury to his crimes under oath, and even then, there's no accountability or belief that the government is untrustworthy. that they're not capable of wrongdoing when they've confessed to it. So what haven't they confessed to? What is completely unknown and will never be known is beyond the realms of the imagination. But what we do know is damning enough on its own, what we've proven and what's already been confessed to.
Yeah. And you can't make this stuff up either. You know, even if I was to dream up the wildest, craziest conspiracy theory with all the bloody players and the length of it, I couldn't make it up as brilliantly as it has already been made.
No, these are masters of theater on the global scale. I mean, look at the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which is the inciting incident of the drug war, because it was to crush the resistance to that war that Nixon crafted the drug laws in the way that he did. But the Gulf of Tonkin incident is a classic false flag operation, which Robert McNamara confessed to. The Secretary of Defense confessed that they'd made up the radio report of a torpedo attack on one of their naval vessels in the Gulf of Tonkin, that it was an absolute fabrication, and Robert McNamara admitted that, and nobody has held him or Henry Kissinger or all of the other warmongers, including Nixon, accountable, Lyndon B. Johnson. None of them were ever held accountable for war crimes. None of them were ever held accountable for misleading the public. None of them were ever held accountable for the hundreds of thousands of dead GIs, 50,000 dead GIs from the Vietnam War, hundreds of thousands permanently scarred, psychologically and physically scarred. You know, the atrocities that these people committed were, you know, on a scale of Hitler and Stalin. They're at that level, genocidal, ecocidal, sociopathic behavior on the global scale, and none of them have ever been held accountable. In fact, when Nixon died, all the other still living presidents and ex-presidents and president turned out to salute him as his corpse was lowered into the earth instead of being thrown to the pigs. and eaten by pigs, which is what he deserved. So yeah, there's this hero worshipping that goes on towards the United States president and his aides and his generals and his entourage that is really bizarre. It's like almost a religious cult. And you know, how do you bring down an edifice of that size and of that reach? It's like a David and Goliath struggle that we fight.
I do believe you're right on this particular front. You know, like odds are set against us allegedly. I mean, we've got the numbers, but they got the technology and the brainwashing and the money and the and the history of it, and the whole public's just been educated basically since they first go into school to blindly obey authority.
Exactly. Schools are very similar to prisons in the way they're built, their architectural style, in terms of the way they're run, in terms of the way they are now surveilled, you know, with CCTV cameras. That's basically how people begin their education as state programmable automatons, because it's very hard to get an independent syllabus, especially in the United States. So you're either going to be homeschooled or you're going into this concentration camp of the soul, you know, where you will be instructed on how to serve economic growth and to fit in as a little wheel in this gigantic watch that is the globalized economy.
Yeah. It's a succubus of a syllabus, isn't it?
It is. It is very succubus. And, you know, how many people out there can ever step away from their formative years and, like, begin to look at the world objectively? So if they get you from a young age, they get you from age 4, age 5, and they institutionalize you. Now, I come from a background where corporal punishment was part of the tradition, in fact. It was an integral part of how the school operated. You know, using a cane, you know, 6 of the best, that was a very painful experience and humiliating as well to have some sociopathic teacher with, you know, all kinds of unresolved issues from his own childhood hit you with a cane repeatedly on your buttocks. It can leave scars on your mind as well. So this is how 1,000 boys from my schooling days were treated for 5 years. Ridiculous. And that's kind of like the way governments, not to that level where corporate punishment is used, but hazing, other forms of physical abuse, are still part of school routines, not just in America, but in a lot of countries. So, you know, we're teaching people to be bad, essentially, to be bad and frightened and retaliatory.
Yeah, the old public school started up in Prussia, I think it was, and they were quite surprised when they went to war with France, like this prior to the First World War, that they had all these kids that just lined up, you know, to be bossed around by a guy in
they
uniform,
loved it.
You know.
Absolutely they loved it. We had
and,
cadets
and they resoundingly too. Beat the French, and then the French and everybody else in the entire world says, oh my God, look at how easy it is to indoctrinate children to view the state as something worth dying for and giving up their lives willingly. Let's institute that here. And then the first schools in the United States, they actually had to get rangers like on cavalry back to lasso children and drag them to school from their parents.
They actually kidnapped them. Is that I wasn't aware of that. That's
oh yeah, man. Public schools are bitch.
Yeah, I remember from my school days when we had cadets, that was on Fridays, and you couldn't just go home and enjoy your weekend. No, you had to make fucking squads and march in formation on the rugby field up and down and do these drills like a sweaty mutant and listen to some doofus shout orders at you. And I think the only people who really enjoyed it were the doofus people shouting the orders. Everybody else hated it. But it was a kick for the guy in charge. And I think that's been a huge driver in a lot of people's lives where during their school years they got to be captain of a team or class president or some other silly little meaningless accolade that gave them the approbation that they craved. And it's part of the way they're controllable now, because they seek that same approbation, the status, through a fancy car or a you know, job title that other people will gasp at in awe. And it's because at school he was told to value a certain thing. But if he had been homeschooled by me, and incidentally I have some qualifications as a teacher, and I do teach children art and cartooning, so I have direct experience of this. If I get to educate a child, that child will grow up to be a free-thinking individual. When the state gets to educate your child, that child will grow up to be a consumptive conformist. And that's what we have. We have a population of consumptive conformists out there through the state education system.
Addicted consumptive conformists.
Yep, indeed. Addicted to many things, not just drugs, although drugs are one of the most overt things. Addicted to television. Addicted to cheeseburgers. Addicted to a lot of cheap thrills and instant gratification. And I'm just going to do a quick shout-out now to Madiba, my president, who died recently, Nelson Mandela, may his soul rest in peace. Madiba once said, and I'm going to say this in my Madiba voice, and this is not my Yoda voice.
This is not his more higher pitched voice. This is Madiba voice.
Not the Yoda voice, this is.
The Madiba voice is different from the Yoda voice, and this is the Madiba voice.
The culture of instant gratification is problematic. People must delay the gratification to experience joy.
And I think he summed it up like that. You know, instant gratification is a big problem. People haven't recognized it, and they don't know why they seek it.
I think it's actually quite a painful experience just to be alive when there is nothing to live for. And what instant gratification basically teaches you is that unless you have everything you want right now, there's nothing to live for. Incidentally, one of the other leading causes of death in the United States, which I think recently became like the public number one, other than the medical thing, which to kind of, you know, play that one down, is suicide. Number one cause of death in the United States is suicide. What does it say on all of them pharmaceutical drug packets as a possible side effect? Murder, suicide?
Yeah. It's happening quite a bit, actually. Antidepressants seem to have a depressing side effect in that it could cause you to kill yourself or others, or both.
Now, you see, I've seen a stoner murder a cheeseburger, but I've never seen him murder anybody else, unless he was on something else as well, maybe.
Yeah, you know, it's a funny thing in that a lot of these diseases, and we cover this in the film Drug Lord, in our segment on the comparative benefits and harms of drugs, where we compare cannabis to alcohol, tobacco, and pharmaceuticals in terms of what their benefits are and what their harms are. And we show that that pharmaceuticals are very, very problematic for not only for their high propensity for addiction, but also because of unpredictable side effects. A lot of these drugs can and have quite frequently caused otherwise normal, passive, agreeable people into murderers. And entire families have been slain by people who've actually lost their minds because of antidepressants. So you then hold that up against cannabis, which is a proven antidepressant, and is also proven in treating PTSD, which is why antidepressants are often prescribed. Cannabis has never had that side effect. It's never had the side effect of causing someone to go into a murderous rage. And curiously, if you look at the history of cannabis, it was that lie which caused it to be illegal, that lie put forward in films like Reefer Madness, which, by the way, was sponsored by an alcohol distillery and some church groups. But an alcohol distillery put up the money to make the film Reefer Madness. So, you know, the alcohol industry was taking out a competitor. And alcohol is a drug that causes violence. That's demonstrable and has been proven time and time again. So the drug that doesn't cause harm was made illegal by presenting it as the drug that causes these harms, which are in actual fact caused by these other two drugs, which are legally available and always have been.
And, of course, the manufacturers of those other drugs financed this defamation campaign in order to wipe out their competition.
Exactly, exactly. It's still happening today, you know, in terms of rectifying the drug laws. Pharmaceutical companies are taking a direct role in retarding the process of reforming the drug laws. They have a lot at stake. If, for example, cannabis were legalized and you could grow and produce your own medicine for at least 100 ailments, at least 100 ailments that cannabis has demonstrated can be helpful or even cure, then they lose that enormous swathe of people who would otherwise be dependent on chemical drugs that they cannot produce themselves. They can only be purchased from pharmacies or hospitals. So, you know, they will lose a massive share of their market, and they're holding on to that quite bitterly. And I'm sorry, there's one other thing I'd like to add there. They're also patenting cannabinoids as fast as they can so that they can hold the intellectual ownership of certain cannabis molecules, and the U.S. government itself owns one of these patents. So they're holding back the reforms to get as much of this intellectual property as they can under their own ownership.
So that in the future, you won't get handcuffed and arrested, you'll be served with a lawsuit for smoking weed without permission.
That's right, exactly. I mean, they want to own not just the cannabinoid molecules, but human DNA, all kinds of things like that should not be owned. That's crossing a very dangerous line into a Philip K. Dick nightmare future. And, you know, it's very difficult to step back. And I'm hoping that people out there that are listening to this tonight are the open-minded people who can distinguish the truth from the enormous tsunami of lies that gets washed over them every single day. Yeah, man, it's real hard to keep your attention on what's true when there's so much stimulation of your brain through the media out there that focusing on what you need to do to fix shit now is really hard. And but I think people out there recognize the dangers that they have to face and to get through this dark time in human history.
This dark risen time. Now, there is a danger, of course.
Keep smiling.
That
keep smiling.
When you are exposing scumbaggery, sometimes you become the victim of it. You know, like, I don't know if you've had any brush-ins with the police in the course of making this film.
Oh, yeah.
They have threatened you or something of that
nature? Well, no. Bullying and intimidation on a kind of low-key level. Nothing really that I can complain about, but except for the time they confiscated my camera and hard drives and some tapes, about 75 tapes. And they had to watch. I mean, think about how much that cost. Because the detective told me he watched every single when I went to the police station to make my statement, and I had to go back there about a year later when they turned over the tapes to me. He told me he watched them all. And there was about 75 hours worth of tapes and hundreds of hours on the hard drive. So that was how many tax dollars burned up just watching through these tapes to gather evidence from these tapes. You know, we're talking about thousands of dollars just on this one little segment of his investigation. Yeah, that's your tax dollars at work. Meanwhile, there's 5,000 burglaries, rapes, child beatings, hit and runs, assault with a bottle going on in New Zealand every single night. 200 assaults.
Yeah, but that's dangerous
200
stuff.
200 assaults.
The cops don't want to get involved in any kind of dangerous stuff that would be a danger to them. They want to pick on completely defenseless, innocent stoners because that's a good way to get the feather in the cap without getting your head blown off or your throat cut.
True. It's a lot easier. And it's also one of these crimes where it pops out at you and you know it's going to be an easy bust and you don't have to spend the night stopping real crime. You can just go back to the police station and write a report that you pulled somebody over and patted them down and found some utensil and Section 18 them, and you're going to get the same overtime. You know, you're going to get the same overtime as chasing down a burglar. Who wants to chase down a burglar? You know? You know, they don't have enough donut shops in New Zealand, because then at least cops would have something to do rather than chase after potheads. They could just go and have a donut. And, you know, in fact, though, that's, you know, I want to retract that statement, because New Zealand police, you guys are in good shape. I don't see any slouches on the New Zealand police force. You guys work hard. So I'm taking back the donut comment.
The New Zealand police actually passed, I think, Judith Collins, or as I like to call her, Crusher Collins, I believe.
GDC.
Actually passed some kind of regulation that the police actually have to be in good physical shape in order to, you know, pull duty kind of thing.
Oh no, that's good. That's good. I mean, they look in trim. I'm happy with that.
She also at the same time passed a law that means if you hit a police officer, even when they're not on duty, it still counts as hitting a police officer.
Oh wow, so that's cool. She's, you know, she's quite a mean person. I'd like to talk about how she features in our film Drug Lord. And incidentally, listeners out there, if you'd like to pre-order the DVD at Kickstarter, just go to druglord.com and click on the Kickstarter link. But Judith Collins features in the documentary Drug Lord, and under her auspicious leadership, the prison population in New Zealand has swelled to a record high. And they're now building, to accommodate these this excess of prisoners, 700 of whom, incidentally, out of a population of about 7,000, so just almost 10%, it's actually 9%, of prisoners are there for cannabis-only offences. So it's a significant portion. They have never done anything else wrong. It's just been a cannabis bust. And that accounts for just 9%, or a whopping 9% of the prison population that Judith Collins lords over. She's quite proud of herself, and she wants to expand the privatization of New Zealand's prisons through the new Wiri prison in South Auckland, which they're building right now. And I think that's got 900 new beds. So that's if the statistics hold up, that will be about just under 90 cannabis-only offenders will be warehoused in that lovely new facility. Now, Serco, the weapons manufacturer that is running Wiri Prison and is also running Mount Eden Prison in partnership with New Zealand's government, Serco has a very nebulous record of maintaining these facilities, and prisoners are often complaining about being underfed, underheated, not given the privileges that they've earned, not being supplied with toilet paper. I've heard from prisoners there that they don't have utensils in their cells, and so they have to fabricate a cup out of a milk carton. So even basic things, you know, that you need just to maintain some remnant of your human dignity are denied these people. And I don't think it's because they really want to torture the prisoners like they do in some prison facilities. I think it's just that they want to save dollars, so they cut costs wherever they can, and the prisoners are the ones who suffer as a result. And those people who invested in Serco are laughing all the way to the bank, because their share value goes up with every dollar that Serco saves on these people by stiffing them of toilet paper and food.
I think they even did that to Kim.com, bro.
Yeah, Kim.com actually was serving time in Mount Eden Prison at the same time as Dr. Green, who features in the movie Drug Lord that we're talking about. And I heard secondhand reports of Kim being in prison. Kim, I love you and I hate you. I love what you're doing for internet freedom. I think, though, that you know, we need people of integrity leading the party that you represent now, and that's not you, Kim. So you build it and put somebody who's got the right stuff, you know, who carries the fire, who carries Jafire. Find that person, Kim, put him in charge, somebody who loves the earth, somebody who loves the sky. You're not that guy, but you've got the money. So I'm your guy, Kim, put me in charge, and Jafire will burn.
Something tells me that's not going to work out too well.
No. I met Kim's wife. I didn't meet Kim's wife. I slipped Kim's wife a note, actually, but it didn't go further than that. No, it wasn't call me. It said, get Kim to call me and we'll set up an interview. But no, it didn't happen. So, Kim, I'm still up for it. I'll make you famous.
You didn't give her a foot massage?
No, man. No foot massage. It was outside the courthouse. There was not time. And she was, you know, she was in a hurry too. So no time to massage my feet.
You don't want to be in that ballpark, eh?
No. But Kim didn't want to, you know, I think Kim has got a love-hate relationship with the press, people like you and me. I think you and me, our style of reportage is not going to fit in with his PR. But you never know, you know. You never know. We could one day find ourselves working for Kim.com.
I'll never work for anybody again. I'll work with people. I'll just never work for them.
Yeah, we'll work with you, Kim. We'll work with you.
Yeah. Well, I think the thing is, Kim's a lot like me and you, is that we're all creative people and we're energetic and we're kind of innovative about those things that we're doing. To the point where we don't necessarily need to be in business with somebody else or need to work with somebody else in particular or whatever. It's just, if it works out, it works out and it's good. And you know, as far as I'm concerned, you know, everybody can have their disagreements about little things here or there, but at the end of the day, it's on the points that you agree upon that you should come together and collaborate, because those points that you disagree upon, not only could you argue with about them endlessly, but also at the same time that'll distract you from the bunch of ruthless criminal sociopathic scumbaggery that are trying to exterminate you.
Yeah.
So I think maybe we can start disagreeing about stuff after we get rid of that little problem. That's just me.
Yeah, no, systemic problems in terms of how people are governed. You know, it's intractable. You know, there's never... You know, but the odd thing is that if I can digress to us to a supposedly utopian society that was set up in California during the 1960s, where they tried to, you know, have a society there that was not governed, and it actually broke down into chaos, into you know, a situation where people were being hazed, there was hierarchies, there was abuse, there was all kinds of really strange human behaviors that developed in a situation where there was no governance. So, you know, hopefully in the last 40 years we've learned a little bit more where we can create these utopian societies that don't break down. You know, it's I think the main problem now is keeping your utopian society afloat in the midst of economic collapse, because before the current financial system, you might have been able to set up something that was utopian, live off the land and through barter and so forth. But now, you know, the value of your goods is being devalued every second of the day, every time that debt clock turns over. You know, your ability to trade is diminished as well. So setting up these utopian societies is becoming really difficult. What we can be hopeful about, though, is that you can create a utopian society based entirely around hemp and cannabis, where the main product of your community, and it is an agrarian utopian community in this case, not an urban one, is producing fields of hemp, 50 hectares of hemp, and maybe a warehouse of medical cannabis for processing and sale to the market in a legally controlled market. And such a society is through the production of one single crop. Well, it's a diverse crop, but it's one single plant species. They can produce building materials, clothing materials, all kinds of textiles, substrates for processing things like dynamite, cellulose, plastics, bioplastics. You can produce food, milk, the highest grade oil for human consumption, hemp oil, fuel, biofuel, zero carbon emission fuel, all of these things from a single crop, right? That's a completely self-sufficient and prosperous business structure where your crop is very useful and very valuable, and is also very easy and cheap to produce and detoxifies the soil and has all of these other positive benefits environmentally. Takes a fraction of the resources to grow a plot of hemp than it does to grow wheat or any of these other foodstuffs. So that is a utopian society that's completely plausible. And the buildings can also be made from the cannabis that you're growing.
It's a utopian society. And incidentally, you know, they're talking about skyscraper farms now, bro. Mm. Yeah.
I have heard about that.
I think that would be great. You wouldn't even use to use it. Like, you know, the power structure, kind of like those massive towers or whatever in the Matrix,
mm-hmm.
You know, imagine that. It just a city in the middle of nowhere, just these skyscrapers just jutting up into the air and it all growing copious quantities of hemp.
I don't think hemp would grow well in that situation. Hemp needs sunlight. You wouldn't be growing hemp through electric lighting or indoors like that. But you could definitely grow, you know, tons and tons of high-grade medical cannabis that could be used to cure people of cancer, as is demonstrated in Rick Simpson's excellent film, where he cures I don't know how many hundreds of people or dozens of people just in that one film, people who testified that he completely cured them of otherwise terminal cancer. And I believe you had him on the show, yeah. So I mean, you could cure or make a very large dent in the world's burgeoning cancer rates by making cannabis farms and in these skyscrapers and replacing pharmaceutical drugs as a cure for cancer.
You could call them high scrapers.
High scrapers. That's right. Because and furthermore, not only do you get the medical benefit out of the flowers, you know, whereas, you know, you're growing an opium poppy for its medicinal benefits, you're just taking one small part of the plant. The rest is waste material. With the cannabis plant, you're using the roots, you're using the stalk, you're using the leaves, if you choose to, you're using the seeds, and you're using the flowering tops. So every single part of that plant can actually be made into something useful and valuable, whereas other crops, wheat, corn, all of these things, most of the biomass that's growing out there on the field is actually a waste product, which is going to cost thousands and thousands of hours and millions of dollars and tons of fuel to get rid of. That problem doesn't exist when you're growing hemp. So that's another reason why these utopian, this vision of a utopian society that I project around hemp is completely plausible. The product itself has all the attributes for sustaining a farming community without any other crops involved. Food, fuel, fiber, medicine.
Well, true, but people wouldn't want to only eat hemp all day, every day.
No, of course they wouldn't, although it is delicious. But you see, hemp can be processed into many different things. You know, it won't be, you know, just gruel, which incidentally was the main ingredient in... hemp was the main ingredient in gruel. If you ever want to know what gruel is, it's actually mostly hemp seed. Tastes disgusting. It's hemp seed and water. But with modern cooking processes, you can turn that hemp seed and the hemp milk into a whole bunch of things that don't resemble the original ingredient at all, have wonderful taste, and are 100% vegan. Super healthy. Super healthy. Hemp is declaratively the most nutritious plant on the planet. Yeah, you can live on hemp seeds and water.
Oh, yeah, that's true. In fact, there was a community in Australia that had a drought or something like that, and all their crops failed except for the hemp, and they survived on the hemp. When was that?
No, I'm not too clear on the exact time. But it's the staple diet in Nepal. And when one must also recognize that these drug laws are not just a war on people for using drugs. It's just a war on people in general. It's a war on resources. The Nepalese food crops are wiped out, are eradicated as part of this drug war because those food crops fall under the gamut of the UN's prohibitions. So you get people actually starving because their crops are wiped out by DEA agents and military operatives who are acting under the auspices of the UN and the United States.
I believe that's being called getting treated appallingly.
Yes. By the way, folks, you're at Vinny Eastwood's show, so you're going to hear a lot of bad puns tonight.
I am the bad pun master, and I'm not proud of the title either.
Speaking of food eradication, it's not just in Nepal, it's also in India, where in the northern parts of India, ganja is grown as a food crop. It's one of the staples up there. And I'd like to also talk about ganja and that word and the roots of that word, if I could digress into
Somebody
that.
Somebody asked me once, you know, Vinny, is there weed in India? And I go, of course there is, bro. Why the hell do you call that river the Ganges?
The Ganges River, the Ganga River, that word means cannabis. The Ganga River, the sacred river to, you know, the Hindus and hundreds of other religions that exist in the Indian subcontinent. That river is named the Cannabis River, if you were to actually translate it. And Shiva, one of their most important gods, is the god of cannabis, and is the sacrament of Shiva is ganja. So, you know, it's deeply rooted into that country's history, I mean, more deeply than any plant, really, much more deeply than any other plant on the planet, and it's prohibited. So, you know, it's a very bizarre situation where a country, well, in this case, it was because India was under the control of the colonial governments of governance of the same family that rules New Zealand, the English monarchy. Were controlling India at that time, and they're the ones
the Saxe-Coburg-Gotha.
Yeah, it goes back to the Germans. They're not even English; they're Germans. Anyway, because they had colonial authority in India, they made cannabis illegal, and this integral part of Indian life was made illegal from that time forward. So, you know, there are certain provinces in India where it's state regulated the bung shops, but you know the productivity of the entire Indian agrarian sector was undercut massively by banning one of their most essential crops along with rice. So, you know, it's damage to their environment because of the alternative crops causing so many problems and using so much water. Compared to cannabis, which is very soft on the environment, is astronomical, and that's another one of these unwritten costs of the drug war. You know, it's an ecocidal program, and a little bit later I'll tell you about the police action in around Gisborne with regards to cannabis eradication. It's a frightening story. Oh, okay. Well, I'll explain it now. So I met a grower who was quite big at that time, probably second biggest importer or provider of cannabis during that period is Mr. Asia. He knew Mr. Asia, but they were not partners, and he avoided Mr. Asia because he thought he was a psychopath. So this grower who I'm going to interview, and this is going to be in the extras of the DVD of Drug Lord for those of you who want to see his own testimony. He was growing in the forests around Gisborne, and he was living out there to protect his crop from the police and from patch pirates, and he'd become kind of like a wild man of the bush from living out there for so long, and he had thousands of plants out there, and he was watching from the hill one day when he saw a convoy of police trucks arriving in the middle of the night. And there were about a dozen trucks or a dozen vehicles, including several trucks with cages, multiple cages stacked on the backs of these trucks. And 20 or so policemen jumped out of the vehicles and opened these cages and released full-grown possums into the forest, with the intention that the possums would sniff out all the weed plants, which they really like to eat because they're such a nutritious source of food, not just for possums but for many, many animals. But the possums, because they're particularly voracious, would sniff out all the crops in the forests and destroy them. And that is, in fact, what happened. And it was this police action which introduced possums into this region. There were no possums in this region before. So sorry to all the birds that got eaten and all their eggs that got eaten and all the other fauna and flora that was decimated in this invasion of full-grown possums that are probably still entrenched in that region outside Gisborne today. We applaud you, New Zealand police. Making New Zealand safe.
You know, that's on a par with the Scotsman who said, hey, you know, it'd be a really good plant to introduce, you know, for hedges? Some gorse, yeah.
Yeah,
it's prickly,
yeah.
It grows everywhere, you can't stop it. It'll be great.
Great hedge material. Yeah, well, a lot of misguided things are happening. A lot of misguided things. I still see 1080 all over the place. There's this deadly poison that they want to drop. I'm sure the 1080 manufacturers are laughing about that.
Incidentally, you know how you're talking about the possums killing all the birds and everything like that?
Yeah.
Well, apparently there's no surveys to prove that claim. And there's no surveys of any TB analysis or anything of the entire population either. We're the only country in the world that drops 1080and licenses it for outdoor use. We consume 95% of the world's supply of 1080 made by one company in the United States at $50 million a year.
Not even a New Zealand company that's benefiting from the poisoning of
everything. It kills
New Zealand's
everything.
Rivers, it's a forests. Yeah. What's this company called?
Oh, fucking if I know. I'll interview Clyde Graff. He made the movie called Poisoning Paradise, a really good film about 1080 there. It's on my YouTube channel, bro. I'll send you the link later on. But yeah, man, it's a total farce, you know. And they're just dropping 1080 in there. In my opinion, it's again the ecocide agenda. They want to kill everything that lives in that because why else would they use a substance which is a food chain poisoner? All right, bird eats it. It dies. Then a cat, then a feral cat or something like that eats the dead carcass of the bird. It dies. And then a couple of bugs come along to start eating the carcass of that cat. They die. Then a couple of birds come along to eat those bugs, and then it dies, and the cycle starts again. It's the circle of death.
Indeed, it's quite frightening. There's a book out now called The Sixth Extinction, which explains how the rate of dying off of species on this planet now has equaled the rate at which the fifth extinction reached, which was caused by an asteroid striking the Earth and blacking out the sun. So, you know, we're on par with blacking out the sun right now. I think the problem is that, people are too distracted to focus on the problems and the severity of the problems. And they're just too gratified by all the cheap thrills that are thrown at them. I'm going to quote Nelson Mandela again soon, but you go ahead first.
I would say it's two words, bro. Learned helplessness.
Learned helplessness. There's entrenched laziness that helplessness and laziness, I guess they're the same thing. Because if you feel helpless, you're just too lazy to help yourself. And that's the state that this torpid state that humankind has entered into now in the age of mass media. And I want everybody out there to turn off their televisions. Turn off Game of Thrones is stupid. Turn off Game of Thrones now. Read a fucking book. Read the newspaper, not the New York Times. Washington.
Go fly some predators or something.
Turn off Fox News.
Have a game of drones.
Turn off Fox News.
Obama will hire you.
Start watching Russia Today. Start watching Al Jazeera. I know a lot of people in Mississippi and Alabama are going to hate the sound of that, and Al Jazeera is a swear word to you, and Russia Today sounds communist, but those are the only trustworthy news sources that I think are out there right now, so please turn off Fox News. Thank you. This was a public service announcement.
And notice he did not include the Vinnie Eastwood Show in his other two lists of credible sources, which is actually accurate because I'm not credible, all right? I'm
incredible. You're incredible.
Yeah.
Am I allowed to get some water? Give me a two-second break, folks.
You know what? We actually have come to the 55-minute break for the second hour, so let's, we are going to, but let's. I need to take a WikiLeak as well. We'll be right back, folks.